Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe David Olson. He is the Artistic Director of Theater Work, and he is the director of the new play, The Drawer Boy, which opens this Friday, the 15th of October, and runs for a couple of weekends. Welcome.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
So this is a play that was written in the late 90s. It's set on a small farm in Canada, and it's about two men who have known each other since childhood. They went to war together. One of them was injured and lost his memory. The other takes care of him and really shares the has the memories for both of them, keeps telling him the story of their lives each day. And then at the very beginning of the play, a young man comes in. He wants to write a play about farming and wonders if he can watch their lives. So that's the setup of the play. Why did you choose this particular play?
I chose the play because it's beautiful and beautifully crafted. And also I think it resonates with something that I've been re-wrestling with in my life. Many years ago, theater work worked in story collecting projects and went out into, you know, very diverse places and took people's real stories and then made plays out of them. So this young man you talk about, Miles, arrives there, as we often, I'm sure, did back in the 70s, sort of innocent and naive as to what the impact of what we might do with people's stories would be on their lives. We had some sense of what it would be on the lives of our audiences, of course, but not always as aware, I think, as we might have been about the impact of someone telling their story to a stranger and what might happen when that story came back to them in a new form. One would hope that mostly that would be a good impact, but I'm wondering now if it was. And so this play addresses that idea that what truth is the best truth when one is looking at one's life. You know, the stories we tell ourselves help us move forward. And sometimes those stories have to be changed, or something happens that causes us to have to tell a new story. And sometimes that can be very disturbing. Or other times, maybe it's some freedom comes to us because we're now telling a story that's closer to the truth. The truth.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's a play without being at all highfalutin in any way. There is this whole set of questions about what are the stories. It makes you think yourself, what is the nature of the stories that I remember about my life? What is the nature of my memory? And you realize when you're, well, I was reading the play, I haven't seen it yet, that you are continually remembering not the events that you live, but remembering the stories that you tell of those events.
Absolutely, I think that's the case. And in this beautifully crafted play, we have this friend, as you said, who becomes the memory of his friend and then has decided which stories are the stories that are best for him. Nothing evil about that, or nothing intentionally destructive or even limiting about that. But the fact that he does that gives him this very special connection to his friend. He becomes his memory. And so that, I think, to watch that on a stage, I'm sure this is what I'm about to say is true, is very compelling and very moving. We've been rehearsing the play now, of course, for several weeks. And for 2 weeks, we've been inviting people in already to see it because it's been on its feet entirely. It's been running for 2 weeks up till
As rehearsal, but running
completely. And so we've had an opportunity for people to see it. And not only people that we know, or not only theater people, but just some people that I know for other reasons and have invited in. And I've been able to watch their reactions to the play and even hear them and listen to what they have to say after they've seen it, once they can sort of in some cases, compose themselves a little bit. The play isn't disturbing, but there's a kind of sadness that I think it evokes. I'm not sure that it is sad, but it evokes a kind of sadness in people.
Well, I suppose nothing can be sad in itself. It needs people to be sad.
It's not just sad sitting there.
Right.
You know, we have a copy of it on the table. There's nothing sad about it.
Right.
I was thinking when I knew I was talking with you, it's a little bit like how scripts are. I mean, it's like having a lovely car, a beautiful car, a beautifully engineered car in your driveway, but it's not the same as taking a big ride in it. You know, you get in it and go and head somewhere. And that's what happens with theater scripts. You know, they just are like a vehicle, literally, that you step into. First the actors and the designers and the directors and all of us step into them. But then we open the door and say, get in.
Yeah.
And off we go. And it's not really, nothing has really happened yet. Until the people are there, not really.
Until some audience is there.
Absolutely, it's just not theater yet until they're there.
I have not, like I said, I haven't seen the play yet because the rehearsal that I went to, there was an emergency, and so it didn't happen that day. And so I just went home and read the play, and I don't think I've ever, before an interview, had that experience of having read the play but not seen any part of a rehearsal. And it made it so clear to me how interesting the position of the actors and the director is, which is that you take this thing, which must have been fully realized visually and in all kinds of ways in the mind of the playwright who wrote it, but unlike a novel, it holds so much back. Mm-hmm. You have to apply, and the playwright gives you latitude to apply your creativity to it and to make it whole, to complete it.
Mm-hmm. It does. Playwriting is a very generous artistic activity, I think.
It is.
Because you really release it. You give it over into the hands of anybody that wants it, that says, oh, I want this. I want to try to put this on its feet and make it live. And it can be anything. I mean, if one were to go to, you know, three or four productions of the same play, In a span of time, I'm sure it would be very differently realized. Always coming back, of course, to that core, which is the playwright's core. One doesn't change it, doesn't change the lines or the order of the lines, of course. And yet, as you say, the response, even, you know, the response that an actor has to the characters that you read, you know, where do they find that those characters in themselves, and they have to. There's no doing it without doing that.
They start that process pretty heavily before the first rehearsal.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We do an early read-through with everyone some weeks before starting, actually getting on our feet and getting going, so that we've all heard it together and talk about it then. And in some cases, I might meet with an actor in that period before we start rehearsing and just talk with them about what they're discovering or what seems to be, you know, what seems to be a really something really important to look for. But it really, and then when we come together, and as they start lifting away from the script through the process of memorizing, then the thing grows roots, and this play. As you're in a way, you're pointing out, this script has built in a type of inarticulateness and a core of silence, a core of the not remembered, the word that can't be found, the emotion that has no description, no name. And the actor doesn't even get a name for it. They can't just simply say, well, he's angry or he's upset, obsessed. There are very few names for the emotions that this play carries within it, which is another thing that makes it lovely. I was thinking that it's like coming upon a life, you know, of good people. You come upon good people. You don't know their life. You can't know it immediately. But we're there just long enough in their presence, just sort of looking through their window, you might say, or sitting in a chair on the other side of their room, so that we can come to know them suddenly. I mean, 90 minutes is sudden to have that much revealed. But there's so much that's not spoken. And that's been exciting. That means that the design team has some lovely work to do, which is to embody in what then the audience sees and hears that isn't text, music, and sound, the way light touches on objects and touches on action and reveals and helps shape action and mood and feeling. That's the thing about theater. Theater is all those things. Otherwise, we would just become a bookstore and sell scripts.
Right. Right, or you'd write novels and everybody's experience would be individual as opposed to the ensemble experience of working, you, the director, and the actors working together and then sharing that with a room full of people.
Room full of people. The missing part is people tend to go home right after the play. There's no way of making them stay, of course.
You could have a Q&A.
I guess we could, but even that isn't what I'm hungry for. I'm hungry for conversation with the audience.
In this
I'd
town,
love to
David,
know.
They would stay. Are you
would
kidding
they?
Me? Are
okay.
You kidding me?
Well, we'll try. We're always there in the lobby, so if people want to stay and they want to sit back down and talk about it. Sometimes when people want to talk about a play like this is some days later.
Yeah.
When they've had actual time. Or when they've said, in the play they might experience, ooh, that reminds me I haven't called my brother for 2 years. I'd better.
We're talking to David Olson. The play is called The Drawer Boy. As in a person who draws. As opposed to a chest of drawers. And that's the new production of Theater Work that's opening this weekend. One of the many things that's so interesting about this play is that there's not really heroes and villains. They are normal, decent people who are living. And in that sense, it's a lot like the real life that most of us live, as opposed to a stylized sort of comic book that a lot of contemporary, especially movies, seem to want to make life into. And it is so much about friendship and the depth of friendship and the loyalty involved in friendship.
And the devotion and the dedication that friendship takes. We know we have some sense that something like love, what we call love, takes those things. We don't always, I think about how friendship also requires devotion and attention and all of that.
And sacrifice.
And real sacrifice. And I think the friendship between men is something that isn't often enough explored in art, too. Just exactly. The rivalry between men is very well explored.
Right.
Absolutely. The violence that's engendered by that is very well explored. But this lovely and complex, don't let me make it sound as though it's somehow sweet. It isn't. It's a very complex connection between these two men. 30 years of living together and one being the memory of the other. I mean, very complex. And then into that comes this utter stranger. He couldn't be more strange. He's 19 or 20, theater guy, an actor, thinking he's going to just watch Farmers for 2 days and then go away and write about it.
And the funniest things happen. I mean, like those stories of the natives in the rainforest who tell ridiculous stories to the anthropologists who are trying to study them.
Exactly. And that happens here.
Yeah. He makes the guy, Morgan, the character with the memory, makes the young man do ridiculous tasks.
He does, just to see if he'll get it, just to tweak him, just to see if he's paying attention. Not in an ill-humored way, but just to get him, just to see if this kid can wake up and understand that things aren't going to be so easy. And they aren't very easy on a farm, of course.
One of the things that you did was the character Angus, who has lost his memory, is brain injured. He had an injury during the war. And you have made sure that it's really accurate in terms of how people with brain injuries behave.
We have. We were fortunate to have someone who works with the company, who is Richard Gonzalez, who not only functions as a props master with theater work, but actually by profession is someone who works with people with brain injuries in an effort to help them regain speech or to, you know, to put together their memories. And so he came in. He's come in then again several times. He was there again just the other day, just to watch over that, because we didn't want to create a stereotype of that. We didn't want to be untrue to that, you know, and maybe exploited in some way or over, you know, over, if you pardon the expression, over-dramatize it. We wanted to make it real. And he made it very clear that that injury is very specific to a very specific, the one that's described in this play, very specific to a part of the brain that affects one function, memory, short-term memory. So other functions are all there.
And this guy's a mathematical genius.
He is. You can, I mean, suddenly he can give you, you know, you say some numbers and he can not only add them up, but he can give you percentages. You know, he's counting the stars.
And he remembers those.
He remembers all that.
Yeah.
He remembers numbers. Yeah, that's another factor of these injuries. It also is true that there are moments when it's possible that someone with that injury suddenly has a kind of awakening. Or partial awakening. Often not a, you know, we're not back to what we were, but there's some piece that was gone comes back. Maybe in the wrong order, though, or maybe valued incorrectly. And that we see in the play, too. It's very, very interesting to see what happens when the memories of Angus are jarred. And what that does to the one who's been the keeper of his memory.
Exactly.
When he no longer is the keeper of the memories. You know, it's really something. It's very... I've been watching it now for weeks, and I tell you, I am very changed by it, actually. I don't always say that. I've directed 200 plays in the last 40 years, and I'm not always so deeply affected by them. I'm not.
Can you describe what that means for you?
I wish I could. I'll try. Haven't tried, so I'll try. I think part of it is that at my age, at this point in my career, I am inevitably sort of questioning what's the impact of the work. What stands behind me? If I were to turn around and look, what's standing there? What's left standing? What's it been for?
And when all I look, these decades that you've been
these
doing
decades
theater.
Of making theater and wrestling with all these ideas and theories and images and texts and histories and, you know, all of that art history and all of it that I've had to do to prepare myself for all of this work and all of the work with others. Because I've never been alone. I've always been working with actors and designers and all that. I've always had a companion with me, my wife, Paula, 44 years has been there. So there's been all of that. And so I look back, and I should just simply say, I sound ungrateful, I should just look back and say, well, great, wonderful. I hope that that's the case. I try to believe that. So I look back, this play has caused me to ask the question again, but in this very simple way. Is there, this is going to sound, well, however it sounds, I haven't said it out loud before, so here it comes. Is there something good behind me? You know, does it add up? Because in this play, I see goodness. And I want that goodness for others, and I want it for myself. So I don't usually, when I'm directing, when I'm in the moment of directing, I'm directing. I'm thinking, oh, that would be stronger if he were sitting, or that cup needs to be the handle on that cup is doesn't fit his finger correctly. It makes the gesture too difficult. You know, of course I'm directing. But the play has been running now for a couple of weeks, so I'm more observing it now. I'm getting this wonderful experience that I often only get sort of later, where I've got some rehearsals where I just sort of stop, try and neutralize my brain and just kind of watch and see what's hitting me. So I guess I'm going through a kind of a meditative or contemplative process while I watch it. I don't know what that's going to be like for audience. They're going to have to tell me. I think it'll be similar for them, actually. It's a great play. It's a fun play. It makes you laugh. It sort of makes big lumps appear in your throat. But it takes a little work. But I think the work is to just be open, to open, open, open. Keep breathing, keep breathing.
Well, it does. I mean, I think it's a beautiful play. I can't wait to see it. I'm going to go probably tomorrow night or Saturday. But it really brings up these questions which are along the lines of, as you're saying, what have I done all my life? What of the things that I've done have been worthwhile? What, when I die, am I going to think, I'm so glad I did that?
Yep.
And a lot of those things, I mean, there's very few people probably who would look back and say, boy, I'm glad I was a corporate raider and took over all those companies and put those people out of work for my profit. But it's the simple things like, I loved well.
Yes, exactly. And I took care of others, at least one other.
Yeah.
We can't hope for so much more than that.
Right.
But to really know that we have taken care of someone, I think. And also allowed ourselves to be taken care of. And that's the harder thing for me to think about, frankly. I don't know how good I've been at that, to let myself be the recipient of the generosity of others. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I'm not doubting it, but I just don't know for sure yet. Maybe sometime soon I will.
Well, and the play makes you think about that, and it also makes you think, and the way you've staged it, because I have seen the set, the very simple and beautiful set of the play, and I'm imagining how it all comes together. It just makes you think about the simplicity of beauty, and of even mundane and kind of worn around the edges beauty.
Yes. And the beautiful really has, basically, essentially, at the core of the beautiful is just this radiance. You know, it's just this energy which is radiant, by which I mean that comes towards and envelops. That then we know we're experiencing the beautiful. And we can experience it, as you're saying, in the simplest place. In fact, we have to. We can't surround ourselves. We couldn't even appreciate a surrounding in which we were just packed with beautiful objects and stuff. Why would we, you know, how much of that could we do, and why would we have to do that? So to find, I think the beautiful is found in that generosity of spirit and radiance, I think, right around there, the objects that embody it, the thing that's passed between us that embodies that is the beautiful thing. And the work of theater is always the beautiful. I mean, that's hard. You know, if somebody really said, what's your job? I'm just say I'm the artistic director of a theater company, but actually I'm in the beauty business.
Well, you're in the truth and beauty business.
Okay, that too. Darn, beauty would be enough. That's right, truth and beauty. But as somebody said, the theater is the lie that leads to truth. You know, our job is to construct. It's not. We're not psychotherapists. We're not. You know, nothing. We're not running a cruise ship. We're creating these times when people can come together, as you say, in the same room, which I think is still. I still think that's extraordinary, to be there with others, and to experience something together. And how old is that? That's an old, old human activity. It's been forever that people have gathered around a, you know, fire, and someone's told a story that frightened them or moved them or made them laugh or made them remember someone they've lost. I mean, that task and that activity in human communities is very ancient, and we do it all the time.
Well, I hope that all of our listeners get a chance to see this play. It's called The Drawer Boy, and I guess when people see it, they will find out who the what the drawings were and all of that. We don't have to tell you the whole play. and it's at the James A. Little Theater starting this Friday, tomorrow the 15th
night.
Of October, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 2 o'clock. And then the following weekend, the same thing.
Except Thursday is also a Thursday next.
That's right. Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30 next weekend, the 21st through 23rd, and then Sunday at 2 o'clock. Yep. For reservations, people can call 471-1799. David Olson is the Artistic Director of Theater Work and Director of The Drawer Boy. Thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thanks very much for having me here today.
I'd like now to welcome to the show Dan Hoyle. He is an actor, writer, and performer. His one-man show, The Real Americans, is coming to Santa Fe this Friday and Saturday, October 15th and 16th, at the Lensic Performing Arts Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about how this show came together. You left San Francisco to travel to many small towns in America. What were you looking for, and what did you find?
Well, it really started in the brunch cafes of San Francisco, eating overpriced brunch and talking with my friends who were saying, you know, hey, you guys want some of this fruit compote? The pears are house-braised and the syrup was sustainably raised on reclaimed industrial land in Detroit by an alternative girls' school for children of the Taliban. Go ahead, Pete. Who knew saving the world could be so delicious? Actually, Dave, we're politicizing people one meal at a time.
Hey, you guys like my new shoes?
Those are sick, Marlene. I love that mushroom green color. It's, like, so ugly that it's pretty. And so I'm here with my friends and sort of drowning in sort of urban, liberal, yuppie waters and looking for some tough country wisdom. So I bought a Ford van with a bed and back and a fridge and set out to travel through small town America and get some of that tough country wisdom.
And so what did you find? Did you find the wisdom you were looking for?
I did at times, but what I found more was some of the sort of populist anger that is so much in the news now. Angry at the country that their direction the direction of the country is going, and so this was, you know, difficult for me because I had hoped to create this sort of Valentine to small town America, and in fact what I was finding was something much more complex. So so the show then becomes sort of this back and forth between sort of the two Americas that I think are sort of have grown very, very far apart from each other, and I'm sort of bringing them on stage, and drama and comedy ensues.
The much talked about anger that you refer to among, let's call them anti-Obama Americans, what does it look like, first of all, and on a deeper level, how do you understand it?
Well, it's funny, you know. There's one character who says he's a brunch character. Actually, I'm telling him, yeah, it's difficult. And he says, Dan, yeah, I could have told you. You know, I mean, look, the economy's gone. You know, it's been gone. You know, these guys get a job out of high school, a boat to get drunk on every weekend. You know, all the black people called them sir. Their children going off to college. Now what? You know, only Walmart's hiring. There's all these brown people around willing to work harder for less. Maybe your mayor's black. Your daughter can get an abortion. They don't pray anymore at school. They just pass out condoms. And, oh, yeah, men in Iowa are getting married. Yeah, heck yeah, I can't wait for the rapture. And he's being really flip, but essentially what he's talking about is that for some of the country, they aren't happy with what's been happening, the direction that America is going, and it's there's definitely economic issues going on. The manufacturing base and the agricultural farming communities have been, really been pulled the plug on over the last 30 years. And then there's also social issues, and it's funny because you hang out in liberal cities, and all people can talk about is, oh, God, it was so bad under George Bush. I'm going to go to Europe. Well, no, I'm not, but I'm just going to threaten it. And then you get out there, and people are talking about that the country's become more liberal. So it's an interesting time, I think.
Sometimes when these conversations happen, and I'm so glad you're doing this performance because I think it's very important and very relevant and something I've been thinking about a lot, but sometimes when these conversations happen where people say, I don't like the direction the country is going, from the point of view of the so-called real Americans who are in your play, I really wonder how much of it is coming from a deeply held sense of values and analysis, and how much of it is kind of received wisdom from Fox News and talk radio and things of that ilk. Could you get a sense of that?
I think it's there's probably a little bit of both. It's funny because what I went out to get when I was hanging out in these, drowning in San Francisco yuppie liberalism, I went out and what I was thinking about is just a few weeks before I had been hanging out in small town Wisconsin, and this guy, he was talking to me and he was saying, oh yeah, before that I was in Iraq, first Gulf War, 91. The people over there, totally freaking different. Robes, everybody's wearing robes, going on a la, no beer nowhere. Imagine a society with no beer. I'd start blowing up stuff too. So, there's a great delight as well in talking to people. I'd be hanging out in small town Alabama, and this guy looks at me and says, you ever notice terrorists never mess with Alabama? They're smart in that way. And his girlfriend says, I mean, Dan, it's like, I mean, Alabama, that's a good thing about it. I mean, what is there to blow up? So people have a great sense of humor, too. Throughout my time and talking to people, the other huge thing that was happening was incredible hospitality. Crash in our yard here, have another burger, have another beer. Sometimes people didn't drink, so they, I say, hey, you want a beer? That's a joke. We don't drink. They're making more iced tea. But the hospitality was so strong. So it was a very interesting mix of feeling sometimes very alienated in terms of worldview, but at the same time incredibly welcome just on a basic human level.
One thing that I appreciate from just what I've seen so far, I haven't seen the whole work yet, and I haven't seen your other pieces, I'm so looking forward to it, but is that you really do these little portrayals of people without caricaturing them. I mean, you present them in the way that they speak, which I think is important, not to get into a judgment. And in fact, you turn your lens on everybody, as we have just heard.
Sure. I go around and I really try to understand the world through the eyes of people living it there, and put that on stage and sort of allow the audience to make their own ideas based on what I'm finding. And obviously I'm a playwright as well, so I work a lot with this raw material and create a narrative. Sometimes I need to do even more. There's a character, Jack, who's a mechanic in Kentucky, and he speaks with such an intense accent. Sometimes it's hard to pick up. He says, man, a lot of people here don't have to stop working. Where you go, you ain't going no more. When you stop working, that's quitting. Pretty much that means you're fixing dying, don't it? And so for him, I help people out with some super titles, actually.
Right.
But, I think it is important to to get to know people, and I try to do that for people that can't necessarily buy a van and spend 3.5 months driving around the country.
Now, you are an incredible craftsman, I think, both as a writer and as an actor, with a true, both, I think, gift and long-time study of what would you call it, mimicry or imitation, or really getting people's body language and speech patterns and inflections and so on down.
Thank you.
Do you use videotape? What's the process of crafting this performance like?
So I go out, I only use audio, I just find for some reason that it's easier, it's more comfortable, and I can still exist in the moment of the interaction. You know, I often say our brains are like computers, and I think there is some evolutionary benefit to being able to take in somebody and reproduce their behavior or their mannerism, something like that. I don't know that we have to do it so much anymore to survive, but so I think we all sort of have that talent, so I sort of work on that. But I take notes, I record people, I come back, and then I start working on, I usually start with the voices, and then I go into the bodies and work in front of a mirror, then work with my director, Charlie Varon, and do workshop performances and really try to create these characters from the ground up, sort of inspired from often several different people that I've met on the trip.
What is it like to perform, or have you performed, in the communities from which you've gathered the characters?
I haven't had the opportunity yet to do that with this show. My previous show, Things They Happen, was about Nigerian oil politics. I spent 10 months in the Niger Delta oil-producing region of Nigeria, where the U.S. gets one-fifth of its foreign oil. And then the State Department sponsored a tour back in Nigeria, so I played 5 Nigerian cities, and that was a hoot, because it, all of a sudden, here's this white guy from the other side of the world performing their lives, and it was actually pretty inspirational. You know, I would do the policeman taking the bribe at the checkpoint, and everyone would just, hey, that's us, that's what's happening. But that show started in 2007, so it took a while for me to able to go back to Nigeria. This show, I just started this year, so I haven't yet had an opportunity. But I look forward to it. I think that I try to make my shows as entertaining as possible, and I want people to laugh a whole bunch and maybe cry, but then leave the theater with really thinking about what it means to be living at this time in a deeper way.
It's funny, you in I think on your website and various places, and so many people do this, characterize places like San Francisco and Santa Fe and Berkeley and Austin and Cambridge and so on as bubbles, as liberal bubbles. And I've come to object to the metaphor of bubble, because, you know, bubbles are fragile and pretty and ephemeral and unstable. And these cities are really like magnets, you know, they're centers of learning, they're growing and dynamic, and people from a lot of these small towns that you visited, if they can get out, they do, and they come to these places. Very few people go, as you did, to these small towns and really listen to them. And I guess what I was wondering was, from your point of view, looking at these so-called two Americas, these people who don't understand each other and who are politically and culturally separated in a lot of ways, what do you think it would take for more understanding and friendship to occur?
Well, I hope also the place serves as a sort of an inspiration for people to take their own trips. I think it can't do anything but good. There's one character I meet out in small town Ohio who's actually a Dominican from New York, and he said, "Oh, hey, yo, ma, do." You can't believe we meet up again, you know, because it's me, Ramon, yo, ma, do. And you know, he gives this whole quite a fascinating story about his encounter with someone in a coffee shop, and it's all about sort of what being an American is in today's day. But the end of the day, he's like, "Yo, Madu, you got to come back to New York. I try to tell people out there, they don't believe me, right? Most people, they just like to fly." And I think that's true. I think that you know. And oftentimes, even if people drive, you just go from interstate, you know, city to city. You know, I made a point of trying to get off the interstates and take some of the back roads. And there's still so much rich regional culture in the bayous of Louisiana, in northern New Mexico, which isn't actually in the show because the show took on a different sort of tilt. But I was able to visit some of the places up there, you know, in Appalachia, in the Mississippi Delta. There's still places where I think most people would say, wow, I didn't know that America had this too, that this is America too.
Dan Hoyle is an actor, writer, and performer, and his one-man show is called The Real Americans. He will be in Santa Fe at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center tomorrow and Saturday, October 15th. For tickets, you can call 505-988-1234. Dan, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
And, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be giving away some tickets right now to the Dan Hoyle performance for Saturday night. Please call 428-1259, 428-1259, and maybe you'll get some tickets. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Rabbi Martin Levy. He will be speaking at the Hamakom Congregation on Thursday, October 21st, at St. Bede's Church, and his talk is about Buber and Heschel, 20th century American thinkers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you today.
So tell us about these two thinkers and how you chose them for your talk.
I was invited by the leaders of Hamakom to give a special lecture this fall. One of my special interests for many years is Jewish philosophy. I did my master's in Jewish philosophy. And I thought two of the most significant thinkers and writers in the 20th century were Abraham Heschel and Martin Buber, who were both Europeans who later in their lives came to America and taught.
Right.
So I thought this was the ideal kind of topic. Many folks from the congregation were interested in contemporary religious philosophy, and that's how we chose this subject.
Now, when you talk about Jewish philosophy, what is specifically Jewish about it?
In part, the Jewishness is based on their own historical and biographical background, their own training in their younger years. Buber was considered a prodigy, raised by his grandfather, never went to any kind of parochial or private public school. He was simply tutored for many years, and then as a teenager was recognized as a scholar and became a student of Hasidism in the beginning of the 20th century. He was probably the first European thinker to write some definitive essays and then later some books on the development of Hasidism in the 17 and 1800s. And then from there, he went on to develop his philosophy of dialogue, which was offered in the form of the book I and Thou, published in the early 1920s. So that his own Jewishness, his own extraordinary intellectual background kind of shaped his Jewish thinking.
The philosophy of dialogue, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by the essence of dialogue, Buber developed this very short and sweet book, that it wasn't, in a sense, a unique or a new idea, but he took the notion of a profound interchange or reciprocal give and take between both speaker and listener and called that the life of the dialogue, or the life of dialogue. He said that in every encounter there's a moment of potential dialogue between human and human, between man and woman, between man and man.
What about man and God, or woman and God?
And the extension of that, as he said, extended the lines of relationship lead to the dialogue between man and God. But as you and I know, we live in a world defined by objects. And most of the time we deal with other human beings as objects. We need things, require things, we teach things, we work for things, we use the other human being as an objective opposite in order to create those situations and those consequences. And Buber was talking about dialogue as the ideal, the stretching of the human soul towards a true relationship where the objective status of the other person is no longer important. It's what goes on between the two persons that really matters.
And tell us just a little bit about Heschel.
Heschel is born about 30-some years after Buber. Heschel was born in the early part of the 20th century. He was a scion of a famous Hasidic family from Poland. He was recognized as a genius as a young boy. And as a teenager, the question in his family was, should he just be completely trained as a traditional rabbi, or should he be given the opportunity to go to Berlin and study philosophy, which he requested of his uncle and his father in order to become a doctor of philosophy in religion. And the decision was made in in the early 1920s to let him go to Berlin and pursue his rabbinical studies as well as a doctorate degree in philosophy, which was very unusual for someone in his community, since it was the Hasidic world of Eastern Europe was very organic and self-enclosed. They rarely would let a young student out, so to speak, to go into the modern secular university world. Heschel was such an amazing writer. As a young student in his early 20s, he already published a book in Yiddish. He wrote poems that were published by various magazines in Germany. And he was recognized when he came to Berlin as a budding potential a great scholar. And he had the capacity to write in three or four languages. So by the early 30s, he had basically finished his studies in phenomenology and had completed his doctorate. The problem was that the Nazis had already taken over Germany at that point. And in order to receive a PhD in those days, you had to have your book published. No one would publish his book because he was Jewish. So it was a real conundrum. It was a difficult time. Eventually he went back to Poland and fortunately got out of Poland and was in Berlin again in 1935-36. His doctorate was accepted and published, and thanks to the reform movement of the Jewish world in America, he was saved from the Nazi onslaught and brought to Cincinnati approximately 1937, I believe, and that's how he was rescued and able to continue his life and become a great American professor. So Heschel had exerted an enormous influence in American religious life, not only for the Jewish community, but also for the Catholic and the Protestant community. He was chosen to go see Pope John the 23rd in 1961 to represent the Jews and speak to him about the idea of absolving the Jewish community of the crucifixion of Jesus, which came about thanks to John's encyclical. He then became champion of the civil rights movement, marched with Martin Luther King in Montgomery and Selma in 55, 56. And in the late 60s, he was very notable anti-Vietnam War protester and marched with Dr. King in Washington against the Vietnam War. So his influence extended throughout the entire American community.
Rabbi Martin Levy will be speaking at the Hamakom congregation about these two great thinkers, Buber and Heschel, on Thursday, the 21st of October at 7th at St. Bede's Church. I'm sorry it's time to go. There's so much more to say,
you.
But maybe we can have you on another time.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.